Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Even if you don't play an instrument, sing, or consider yourself musical, there's a good chance you enjoy listening to music. Research suggests we incorporate music into our lives because it evokes a strong emotional response, helps us regulate mood, and is an expression of our relationship with others. There are ample opportunities for neurotypical individuals to learn, play, and perform music, but for those with developmental disabilities, the options are limited. A Brookline-based foundation is on a mission to change that. The Music Unity and Social Expansion, or MUSE Foundation, seeks to promote social connections among adults with developmental disabilities through music. Joining us is the executive director and co-founder of the MUSE Foundation, Mia B. Shields. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for being here. Also in studio is Susan Senator. She's the author of a number of books. Her most recent is Autism Adulthood, Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life. Welcome back. Always good to see you.
You too. Thanks.
And on the phone, we have music teacher and also co-founder of MUSE Foundation, Brett Lukacek. Good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning. Thank you.
Sure. All right. So maybe let's start with you. The MUSE Foundation's relatively new, founded in 2016. So tell us the story of how it came to be.
All right. Well, it's a pretty funny story. My first concert ever that I ever played with a microphone, and I was so scared, was where we met Shri, who plays the violin and became Elaine's violin student. Then they practiced together for a year and put together a concert. And at their concert, Shri played with a friend, Stefano, and Matt Allen. And at this concert in this living room, that's where I met Nat and Susan. And it was incredible. And everyone there was like, we need to be doing more of this playing music together, you know. And separately, Elaine and I went around talking to everyone.
And we should say Elaine is your wife.
Oh, yeah. Elaine is my wife,
and
co-founder.
And a special ed teacher.
A special education teacher at Brookline High School. She teaches the 18 to 22 classroom. So this was a merging of her passions. And when I went to see this, I was a neuroscientist. I was saying to everyone, this is amazing. This is incredible. And separately, we went around committing to starting this nonprofit. I mean, we went around being like, we're going to do this. Of course, we're going to start this next week.
They went around the living room. It was Shri's family who put the concert on. And we were invited because Nat and Shri were friends from Special Olympics.
And Nat is your son.
Nat is my son. And Nat right away stood up with the rest of the guys when they took a picture after the concert as if he was one of the band. And then I asked Elaine, can he do it? And she said, sure.
Yeah. All right, Brett, so talk about your involvement here.
Yeah, it was very interesting how I got involved with this. So my wife, Rebecca, works in the field. She's a BCBA, and Elaine was a colleague of hers from the field, and it was all pretty much one funny game of telephone where Elaine was talking to my wife one night, and you know, my wife discussed how in the past I was involved with Best Buddies in Connecticut, and I was doing some open mics over there for individuals with special needs, and how when we moved to Boston, I wanted to try to bring a community like that around here and kind of embrace that culture. And we were connected from there, and it was great. You know, like we said, it was very, very grassroots. It started in a basement, and you know, now we're getting our own space pretty soon. So it's just been a great experience, a lot of growth the last 3 years.
So maybe talk about that. You've kind of got these all ages, I should say. There's some teenagers and adults, and you started at the teen center. Is that where you kind of
right?
We'll start in a basement, but then move to the teen center?
First, we were just practicing out of Shri, the violinist, out of his basement. His parents let us practice there. They didn't care about the noise, but we were kind of outgrowing that space. And luckily for us, the Brookline Teen Center said that they would donate some space. And so we had been practicing out of their space for the last couple of years. And just this year now, we're opening our own music studio. Just yesterday, we got the keys. And it's going to be a big move to have our own space and be able to kind of create it to cater towards exactly what we do.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk about the space in a little bit, but Susan, I want to go back to you. So for parents who have kids with disabilities, they understand this whole concept of aging out. So when the kids are younger, up to age 22, there's lots of opportunities and programs, not so much in the music field, but what happens? Explain what happens when a child reaches 22.
So at 22, the school services end, and right away, 22nd birthday, that's it.
Done.
And then your adult is on his own, basically, has to transfer into adult services where there's basically the option of a day program or a day rehabilitation, or if you can, if you have a job, if you can get a job, maybe you'll work. But the statistics are very bad in terms of how many are employed. Some just are home. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's very few options for my guy, other than Special Olympics.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Nat for people who don't know. There may be people who remember you from past shows, but tell us a little bit about Nat.
Nat is 29 and has a diagnosis of autism. He also has very, very deep anxiety and communication issues. So he's always been limited by society and what he's allowed to do. And if we ever wanted to join in some sort of typical music program, I always had to bring an aide. Mm-hmm. I had to find an aide, pay for an aide, and the aide would have to just basically control Nat. So eventually we just didn't do those things. And, you know, I didn't know that Nat had real music ability until, you know, when he was little and he was just singing songs that we had taught him and shouting songs on the tee. in front of a lot of people on the train. And that was great, but it ended as he got older. He just stopped being interested in that. And sports was the only thing, and then his day program. So he has issues with anxiety. He has issues with figuring out how the world works and relating to other people. He just he's trying to understand the cues, the social cues, and how to respond. And it's all very difficult for him to respond in a timely manner and to process and everything. But we have found that with music, it's very different.
Yeah.
He's right there. He's quick.
All right. So you're in this living room, and this is his friend. He's listening to his friends play. How did Nat come around to being part of this group musically?
He seemed to just do it naturally. He walked over and kind of sat next to Brett, who started just showing him the maracas, something like that, that night. And he was also, like I said, he jumped up to be in the picture when everybody was taking all the pictures afterwards. He was acting like he was part of the band right away. He was very comfortable. He knew some of the people there. But mostly, it's like he just fell into it and found his place.
All right. So I want to ask you how shocked you were when, Nat's in the background, he's playing the maracas, and eventually he goes up to the microphone and becomes the lead singer.
Yeah, that was just mind-blowing. he had once been up at a microphone during his school days. They had done a talent show, and he was singing Life is a Highway. Nothing since then. And then one day they were actually rehearsing. They were singing Life as a Highway in the Teen Center studio. And Nat was standing and wandered over to the microphone. And everybody was looking at each other like, wait a minute, is he going to sing? Because he had been sitting in the back in the rhythm section. And he was singing along. And right away, I mean, the way Elaine and Miyabi are and Brett, they just said, you know, okay, let's give him a microphone. He's going to sing.
And he did.
Yeah. And that was that.
Now, talk about he's singing in complete sentences. He doesn't speak necessarily in complete sentences, but he gets up to the microphone and he's singing in complete sentences. You must have just been blown away.
I was. I was blown away by the sentences and by how he sounds like a typical adult when he's singing those songs. And, you know, to hear him sing lyrics like I'm in love, it is just an incredible experience. It's moving. Sometimes it's a little sad because I don't know if he's been in love. Mm-hmm. I'm hoping he will be someday if he wants that. But it's just, it just makes me so proud and so happy to just see him there being charismatic and confident.
I saw maybe. Do you see this in the other members of the band?
I was also just going to point out that there's these things that we in the staff of the four. So the four founders, it was Elaine and myself and Brett and Max. And we had these things in the beginning that we were calling genius moments that we see every practice, like absolutely every band practice. There is something that happens that is just mind blowing. And Nat stepping up to sing that night. And singing in full sentences and at the right rhythm and coming in at the right time is one of those moments. But those moments happen every single practice. And at the concerts, I mean, the whole thing is just filled with people being surprised is not the right word, but it's awe-inspiring. Yeah. It's something that you're seeing that doesn't just happen, but then it does.
Right.
You know, and it's incredible. And there's these parts of it that are amazing because they're unique and they're different and they're harder won. And that kind of brings a different level to the accomplishment. And this group of people who are able to do this together, being in a band is an incredibly difficult task. It's not, I think people think it might be simpler than it actually is. You have to read visual cues. You have to read the drummer. I know Brett and I are actually in a band together. And I don't know if you want to talk about that, Brett, but we have the same struggles sometimes with cueing each other. And the bands are figuring that out themselves as well.
That was actually one of my favorite moments of the last season from you was when there was one point in time where one of the lead singers of Muse decided that he wanted the composition to be different than how we've been practicing it. And he looked at the drummer and said, you know, let's try to do this. Rather than doing a full drum beat, try just hitting a bass drum a little bit in the beginning, and then we'll work our way up to the full drum set. And us as instructors, we kind of just took a step back and watched them basically break down this song that we've been doing for an entire season and rearrange it and do this great arrangement, and watching them, you know, make cues with each other and basically make it so it wasn't so binary. You know, in the past it could be, you know, this is how the song is on the recording, so this is how we're going to do it live. But they were, you know, our students were starting to realize, like, hey, we've been doing this for a while. We can make these songs our own song. Mm,
that's wild. Yeah. So I imagine it's challenging to get funding for programs for adults with developmental disabilities. So what's your funding model? How do you fund this?
So right now we charge for lessons and we have scholarships on a need basis, and we are currently applying for grants and grant funding, but we function a large amount on donations and on volunteers and voluntary time. A big piece of our ability to run this is because the four founders do a heavy amount of administrative work because we just love it. And this is something that needs to be around. Yeah. It is difficult. I think one of the difficult things is that people, in terms of funding, we're competing sort of directly with children with disabilities, and in which case I'm not saying they don't deserve funding. Mm-hmm. It's just difficult because there is so much established already for early intervention, and sometimes people view adults as completed, like you're already what you're going to be. But that's just simply not true, especially for atypical populations. I mean, we grow throughout everyone grows throughout their entire lives, but you know, your amount of growth and learning and experience and culture and art should not be even close to over at 22.
Right.
And I think that's just a piece of where the difficulty comes in is where there's this emphasis on sort of early intervention and childhood progression so that you can be, you know, as high achieving as you can be. And then, you know, at 22, when you reach adulthood, that then you're already formed and then the services should end, or then I'm not exactly clear on it, but that's where things hopefully will be changing.
Yeah, the system is shaped around that, around the feeling that, well, you got all your supports in school, so now see ya, just, you know, do what you can on your own. And it's really asking a lot of people, especially if they have many, many challenges like my son. So it's actually really not fair. Mm. We need the same kind of supports throughout their lives.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation this morning. 866-999-4626. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point, and we are talking about the Music Unity and Social Expansion, or MUSE Foundation, who is promoting social connections among adults with developmental disabilities through music. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. With us, we have Mia B. Shields, who is the co-founder of the MUSE Foundation. On the phone, we have Brett Lukacek, who's also a co-founder and music teacher, and in studio, Susan Senator, whose son Nat has autism. She's also the author of a number of books. Her most recent, Autism Adulthood: Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life. All right, so Brett, you're a music instructor, not a music therapist. So tell us the difference between the MUSE programs and music therapy.
Well, so Miabi and I are both music instructors in the band, and we have to, sidebar is we're both not trained in music. Music is a passion of ours. We've gotten through a lot in life because of music. We're kind of, we're both self-taught musicians, and the difference is we're not trying to use music as a way, you know, with music therapy to try to help them through anything, and we're not trying to do any formal training. We're not, you know, we're not trying to build the next brilliant musician. What we're trying to do is use music as a tool for social expansion, which is a part of our mission. We're trying to use it as a way to build relationships, find ways that all the different musicians that have been linked together to MUSE, that it's not just the 2 hours or so a week that they're in a room together. Like, we're helping them, you know, make these musical connections outside of MUSE. And we hear stories about how some of these musicians that we're working with are getting together with other musicians on weekends, playing with each other, learning new tunes, and it's coming across with when we're playing together. There's definitely the relationships are showing in how they interact and how they've been playing. One of the things that we really enjoy is that we get concerts for MUSE on Friday nights. You know, we've played in Somerville, we played Hard Rock Cafe, and we're out and about on Friday, Saturday nights, and these musicians are playing gigs, and it's just so normal. It's just friends on a Friday night, like any other musician, getting together at a venue and playing together. And it's just the fact that we're normalizing these activities within the disabilities community is fantastic.
Yeah. Maybe you want to add to that?
Yeah. I think it's interesting because, like Brett said, we're not formally trained. And the other two co-founders, Max and Elaine, are more formally trained. Elaine's classically and Max is jazz. So we were an interesting mixture of people when we started this. And actually, the four of us weren't incredibly close when we started this. Obviously, my wife and I were close.
Yeah.
but the four of us as a unit were really just united by this passion that is MUSE. And it's like the community. It's almost like a cult with Kool-Aid. That's how much we loved it, you know. And interestingly, now Brett and me and my wife, Elaine, are in a band together, and this whole process of playing music and it being a scaffold for social relationships, you know, it's something that, it's almost funny, but we didn't really think about it necessarily in ourselves either as the teachers or as instructors, but it absolutely showed through because music is an excellent scaffold for building significant friendships and relationships because music is integral in many people's lives and your interest is integral in it. But by creating music together and having that common goal and accomplishing that goal together, performing, getting up on stage and being a part of a unit as an identity, you know, that piece of it, of music, it goes a little beyond therapy because it's not as individual.
Mm-hmm.
And I think music therapy is incredible and is a great like thing, but I don't think necessarily that's what we are getting at because we're using music just as the scaffold for this amazing social interaction and this amazing community environment that is just as important in some ways as medicine as a other type of individual therapy. There's like an individual aspect and then there's like the community support aspect.
I wanted to add to what Brett was saying about the normal aspect, the normalizing aspect, where our musicians play in in church basements, and they played at the Hard Rock Cafe, in public places, pass around the hat, mm-hmm. and actually get paid sometimes, and get paid not that much, like most musicians.
Like most musicians. Right,
exactly. So, it's the passion, right? I mean, the passion for the music, yeah. So now many people are reluctant to try new things. It can be scary, you know, getting up on stage in front of people. And so how, Brett, and maybe how do you encourage individuals to give music a try and become more comfortable with playing?
So we kind of, so if we have an individual who does not have a background in music, we have another activity, drum circle. And if we've met someone who's a little bit hesitant, that hasn't really found, you know, their voice or their instrument, we'd say, just come and check out a drum circle, see how this works. And drum circle is it's a very relaxed environment, just a various percussion instruments. And we're just working on basic rhythms, communicating with each other, trying to do ensemble work. And a lot of our students that are now in the bands that have even moved on to other instruments, we've had a couple people from drum circle, actually two of them, in fact, are bass players in a band now. So, you know, it's kind of been a good jumping point. I kind of see it as the farm system in some ways of trying to integrate into music and seeing if it works for you.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I think the drum circle also really helps people to work as a team and as a unit together, creating music. And one of the things that we saw with our students that have come from the drum circle and then been able to pick up an instrument and go into the band setting is that their understanding of how to work together as a group to create music, that's another piece of it. It's not so much just an individual endeavor anymore.
Yeah. What about this? I'm thinking, you know, lots of times there are some people with developmental disabilities who the noise level, the loud, they don't like loud noises. How does that?
Many of us wear earplugs.
Yeah, the bands are so loud.
They are very loud.
We wear earplugs. Nat wears earplugs now.
Oh, there's okay. Also sound isolating headphones that right. You can wear as well. We have them at all of our concerts. And at all of our concerts, we have a sensory friendly room just in case someone needs to be in an area that isn't.
And yeah. it could be an instructor who needs the sensory room.
It's true.
Or a parent.
Absolutely. I have used our sensory room a few times.
Yeah. Susan, talk about the parents, their reaction. I mean, we were talking how blown away you were. And parents have actually, there was a karaoke night that the parents
The Muse did a concert for the Doug Flutie Foundation, which is an amazing autism charity organization. And there was a point in the program where the parents could sing with the band, with one of the bands. And we could sing the songs that the band that the bands were doing, and you know, to a person, we were horrible. We could not figure out when to come in. We couldn't keep a tune, and you know, I think I'm pretty good. I play the guitar, but it was so different with an entire band, and I think we all had a new respect for what the musicians do, and actually a new kind of horror at ourselves.
Yeah, that's funny. All right, Deirdre is giving us a call from Edgartown. Good morning, Deirdre.
Yeah, good morning. I just wanted to make your listeners aware of a movie being shown at the Edgartown Library next week at 1 o'clock on the 8th, and it's called Alive Inside, and it's about a person who had some iPods and went around to senior homes to seniors who never spoke, sat in a chair, stared into space, and he did some research in terms of what the music was when they were younger, and he put them on these iPods and gave them headphones, and it just woke them up.
Yeah.
It's absolutely amazing what it did to these elderly people. And they started talking, they started dancing, they started becoming involved. It's a beautiful, beautiful idea, and it's a beautiful movie.
Yeah. Thanks for telling us, Deirdre. And that's true, the power of music, right? And we've heard this in some of the, you know, people with dementia and Alzheimer's, how they'll sing along to some songs where they can't even speak anymore. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that is one of the things about the brain that interests me so much on a personal level. And my wife, Elaine, actually used to volunteer and play violin at homes for people with Alzheimer's or dementia. And she was just saying one of her fondest memories of that is when you can play something and someone recognizes it and, you know, becomes alive in that way again. And that's, there are parts of music that we just don't understand neurologically in terms of how playing music in a group together affects the brain. It's incredible. It activates so many different systems. You are listening, but you're also coordinating your own movements. You're reading social cues. If you're singing, you're also singing. You're processing rhythm and tempo and chord progressions. It's something that happens in the brain. It's so complex.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right. So, Susan, talk about what you've seen happen with lots of things are going on in his life. But maybe music is part of some of his growth. What's been happening with him?
I've seen Nat really be able to express himself better than ever. It really could be the music, because his mouth and his brain are all getting used to streaming words together. I feel like it has to be affecting that. He has changed his living situation. He's now living in an apartment. It happens to be that he's living in an apartment with Elaine and Miyabi.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
he become very close to them, and so do we. And it's been a really lovely shared custody kind of living situation. And I think he feels like a man, mm-hmm. I think. And so even when he gets really anxious, he's often able to articulate what it is that's bothering him, whereas maybe 5 years ago he couldn't.
Yeah. Are you seeing that with the other band members, Miata?
I think the most striking change within communication within the band members is between band members themselves. I think Brett touched on this a little bit earlier too, but there's so much that isn't actually verbal communication too that happens, like cues, like visual cues, or reading the cues off of each other instead of off of instructors. So like when we started these bands in 2016, now what, 3 years ago, the practices were very coordinated and facilitated by the instructors. We were saying what we're playing and when, exactly for how long. We would always do the same things, right? We had the schedule exactly the same pretty much every practice. And we would facilitate each of the band members playing their part at the right time, in the right moment. And now with the bands that have been playing with us, we have two bands that have been around for 3 years, and we have one brand new band that just started about 3 months ago. And it's interesting. You could already see the new band starting to form these connections too. And it's incredible, because if you go back and watch some of the older videos of our bands that have been together for about 3 years, a big piece of the communication that I see happens between the band members and their ability to coordinate at practice and in the concerts. Yeah. And I think that comes out in their identity.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, when, you know, let's go, hey, let's slow this down and change the tempo. And are you finding that the people in the band now, are they a big part of making the new people feel comfortable and welcome?
Absolutely. And to touch more about what Miyabi said, organically, all three of these bands have developed their own sound. Mm. All three of the bands play extremely different styles of music. One is more based around classic rock. One is in more top 40, 90s rock, and the other one has more influence of 70s hard rock, and that came because the students, the musicians, are the ones picking the song selections, and that's another thing that's changed from the start. We've kind of sat down and be like, you know, maybe this song would be good to bring in, and now we've gotten to the point where we basically, as instructors, put it out there. What do you guys want to play? And that's happened. We really have very little to say in what song selections we do now. and a lot of, and we have seen a lot of encouragement. Some of our students have never sung before, and they, you know, like Nat, and then we have another student that's the same way, and they feel so empowered by this ability to have a microphone in front of them that they've encouraged other friends to join who have never done this before, and they're feeling empowered. And you know, everyone is looking out for each other. Everyone's encouraging each other. Another great moment was one of the guitarists said, if I can have any drummer in the world to be in a band with me, I would have this guy, and pointed to the drummer that he worked with. And we just kind of laughed and were like, well, it's your lucky day because he is your drummer. That's just the kind of relationships that are being built.
Yeah. And go ahead, Susan.
Oh, one cool thing, I don't know if we've touched on this yet, is that some of the musicians are now learning how to compose their own music. And Steph was one of the first ones who did this. And he composed a song called The Brookline Buds, which became the theme song of the group. And the Brookline Buds song is the first one I remember watching where I was watching the instructors stand away. And the musicians were playing it all by themselves. There was no support in there, no supporting guitarist or violinist or anything like that. And to just realize that, you know, this is one of the band members' songs, and here they all are playing it on their own.
Right. So it sounds as though once they kind of get into this and start this, they stick with it, right?
Yeah. And it's something that, so the two of the students that are writing new songs are actually my private lesson students. And I'm so incredibly proud of both of them. But songwriting is something that everyone does it a little bit differently. And it's a form of expression, right? It's a form of art that I think is something that should be, it's a leisure skill. I guess in the field you would call it a leisure skill or something that you do for yourself, right? Mm-hmm. But there's something about then taking that song and then going and playing it with your whole band,
yeah.
Right?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, the sense of accomplishment and, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And so when they start in the bands, do they have this desire to just learn to play, or is there this desire they want to perform? Is that part of it?
Many of our students come to us already playing musical instruments. And so some of them have performed in some context. I don't think many of them have performed in like small rock band ensembles mm-hmm. before. I think the performance is a big goal. It's a huge part of it because you're working towards something and there's a moment when like the lights are shining on you and everything. I think everything comes together at the performances. And yeah. So I do know that a few people have told me, like, I would like to practice with the band, but I'm not sure about performing. And then usually by the time the performance comes up, they're confident.
They don't want to be left out. That's
well, they're confident yeah. enough in the fact that they've practiced. And, yeah. and absolutely, they're part of the band, right?
That's right. Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the Music Unity and Social Expansion, or MUSE Foundation, which is promoting social connections among adults with developmental disabilities through music. In studio with us is Mia B. Shields, who's a co-founder and executive director of MUSE. Susan Senator is the author of Autism Adulthood, Insights and Creative Strategies for a Fulfilling Life. And on the phone, we have Brett Lukacek, who is also a co-founder and a music teacher with MUSE. 866-999-4626 is our number if you would like to chime in. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. All right, so I know this is a question, I guess, for me, or Brett. What instruments are part of your instructional program, and how do you determine what instrument is the best fit?
Largely, our instruments are based on what someone already knows how to play and whether or not that can fit in with one of our current bands or if we have an opening to form a new band. I think Brett is probably going to say the most important instrument is the drums. but we have drums and guitar and bass. Some of our students will play with piano. Some of our students play like a ukulele-sized bass or an electric ukulele instead of an electric guitar or a bass, just because they're smaller and more able. We have auxiliary percussions like maracas and cowbell, and then vocals. We also have a talented flautist, someone who plays the clarinet. So it's really a toss-up. You could work most instruments into a rock band.
Wow. Brett, did you want to add something?
Yeah, we've done a great job integrating. Like, I'm pretty sure, you wouldn't expect to hear the flute in Rolling Stone songs, but we found a way to make it work. And basically, like what Miyabi said, what we have the capabilities to teach. I think all of us as instructors have learned enough of each instrument that we could kind of help everyone out, and then we each have our expertise. Like I work with drummers primarily for private lessons. Miyabi is selling herself short. She could play pretty much any instrument under the sun if you just give her a week to learn it. So she's been all over the place helping people out, from piano to guitar, ukulele. Elaine's been working with violin students, and we've had other instructors who've been helping with piano and bass. And Max Glick, who's one of our founders, developed a really great color-coded way of teaching bass, which has helped a lot of our students, where he's actually on the fretboard has put different colors to help associate colors with what notes to hit. And that's and it's really helped us. Two of our bass players in our band right now are utilizing this method that he has come up with in our bands.
Yeah, music by color. Yep. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah, I adapted that for the ukulele also. Yeah. So he's helped me out. One thing I want to say is that we have all these instruments, but one thing that does seem to be true is that eventually almost everyone wants to sing.
Oh.
At least in part. Yeah. At least in part or in a song. And obviously we love to encourage people to do what they love to do, but we need some instruments in the band.
Not an a cappella group. Yeah.
But it is. I do think that there's something amazing about that, you know, singing in a voice and having, you know, self-confidence, hearing yourself over the microphone and singing.
Do you have a teaching philosophy?
We do, actually. Our teaching philosophy is really flexible, but it's based on creating individualized teaching plans and individualized music and lessons for each student. So it's just a flexible teaching plan where you instruct someone on a skill, some sort of technical skill that you want them to learn, and then you watch them and see how they're doing this, and then you can adjust the way that you're teaching it. And then you can make these adjustments based on what they're interested in. Like, the best way to do this that we have found is to just ask our students whether or not they like something, or to give them a choice between one song or another song, or between one skill and another skill, and to build, not necessarily to build skills in the order that they need to be built in according to classical music training, but to build skills in how they work with a song that they are trying to learn as a band.
Yeah. What do you do with nonverbal students? How do you determine what their interests and what they like?
Usually you can determine based on a reaction of a song. I think it is very clear. I mean, it's not always very clear, but it can most likely be clear if you're choosing between types of music or songs by listening to them, whether or not someone is engaged or not, and finding the part where someone is listening to the music and engaged in the music, and then playing along with the music that they are feeling a connection to. And then, or with that they're feeling a connection with their band too, right? The sound that the band then creates.
I mean, you'll see that someone like Nat, who he's almost, you could say he's almost nonverbal in many contexts, and he will look like he's not paying attention at all. He'll be shaking his hands, you know, flapping, not looking at the band, but he is always on. He will always start singing at the right time. He really is paying attention.
Yeah, that's fascinating. How many students do you have right now?
I think we have about 20. Mm-hmm. Well, the exact count.
Yeah, thereabouts, right? And so you also have some internship?
Yeah, so we actually are starting that right now. Well, we would like to take other musicians and help teach them how to work with adults with disabilities and how to work with our teaching plan, which has been mostly based on letting our teachers develop creative teaching plans and lessons. And I think a lot of that is the opposite of what people expect from music training and how to teach private music lessons. But when you're teaching adults with disabilities, it's really important to be able to adjust your teaching plan, to be able to adjust your goals and your goalposts. There might be something that you need to stop working on because you've been working on it for a little bit and it's not going anywhere. And maybe if you come at it from a different angle, learn something else first, then you'll be able to pick up that skill easier in the future. I mean, specifically like Stefano, who's in Nat's band and is the lead guitarist, he has improved so much in his guitar playing. And I remember in the beginning when I was teaching him, there was a few skills that I thought, like, these are what need to be taught for him to play this certain song. And they just really weren't sticking. So what happened is we went around to another song he was more interested in, built that skill first, and then he was able to come back. And now he can play solos. I mean, he sounds just like the recording and sometimes better.
Yeah. All right. So tell us about the social events. Somebody.
Yeah. So we started social events last year too. It's another thing when we go on break. So we're on break right now currently with Muse. We have our big end of the session concert and then we have a short break. And most of the time, what was happening is our students were being like, well, what am I going to do now that we're on break? What will I do on Thursdays?
Yeah. You know, I was really afraid there'd be a meltdown with Nat to have on his schedule. No Muse. Very sad time. But they do. We've organized. And I say we because I'm on the board. So, and I'm always at rehearsals because I'm a real fan. I'm a groupie. And we've done social events like hang out at a pub where there's games and darts and stuff. And it's always the same. I mean, the parents will be there having drinks. And now our adult children are having drinks, and Nat stood up to play darts with I think it was Miyabi.
Teo.
Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh no, he shouldn't do that. But there he was playing darts, and I mean, it's just all these hidden skills.
Yeah, that you didn't.
And it kind of bridges, the social events will kind of bridge our gap too for the community of people who don't necessarily want to play or perform music, but still want to come and do music-based events. So like, this Valentine's Day, we're going to do an open mic social event at the Bebop in Fenway in Boston. And we're really excited about that because it's going to give people an opportunity to go on stage, but you don't have to. Right. You could come and just enjoy the music and have food. And the social aspect of what we do and the concerts twice a year are amazing opportunities. But that part we want to bring to the community too. So we're doing social events.
Who's eligible to participate
in social events?
In the Muse program.
Oh, pretty much anyone. We don't have any age like cap, although we do have an age minimum. So I think for the drum circle, we were saying 16. And for the bands, it's a hard 22. Mm-hmm. And mostly it's because we believe that being in the bands is something that takes a lot of maturity and that it's something that you can do once you've been through, you know, your schooling and you've had all the experience of working with the group. There's no age cap and there's no necessary like musical instruction experience beforehand. We've had, I think Brett can talk to this, we've had a lot of people come to us with no music experience and have worked their way into a band.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, two of our bass players right now, as mentioned before, started with Drum Circle without previous music experience, and they're doing fantastic in both of those bands, and that they're one of the ones who are utilizing the color-coded way of learning an instrument, which is, I think, fascinating. And I think, you know, Miyabi and Max are doing a great job integrating that into what we do with Muse. And most of the Drum Circle right now have no previous music experience. And, you know, a lot of them have expressed interest in moving up to bands. And a lot of them aren't interested in drums, which I think is great because it's not, you know, we can't really have 20 drummers anyway. So, you know, one of the original Drum Circle students has now moved on and is singing, doing auxiliary percussion and learning ukulele with Miyabi, which we're hoping will be brought into the band soon. So, Drum Circle has been great for kind of helping people find their comfort level before, you know, they hit the big stage, so to speak.
And sometimes also someone will be in, once they get in the band setting too, they realize, oh, I want to contribute something else. So like one of my students, Mariah, was originally singing in the bands and then decided, I want to play the guitar. I want to play the ukulele, and has just picked that up. And wow. It's this thing that is, we view it as very fluid. I mean, musicians can choose their instruments as they please and as they fit in their band, right, yeah. To create the sound. There's no requirements.
Susan, what are some of the positive changes you've seen in the last three decades, and what changes do we still need to make to usher in a more neurodiverse and accepting society?
Wow. Some of the changes I've seen are that there's a lot more information out there for people who have disabilities and how to get jobs and how to navigate social situations, and also for the caregivers and parents. There's the internet, which gives all this support, particularly for people who aren't that good at going out in public. They can have complete relationships with other people online, and they have all the processing time they need. And there's also just more acceptance in terms of things like performance. And I think with the bands, you know, it's a really good example of that. But there's also art programs now. There's a day program right in Brookline called Gateways, where you have artists, and they have galleries and they have Christmas sales, and you know, I've gotten some really good presents there for the holidays. So there's a lot more of the general public just kind of, I don't know, shrugging and saying, oh, I didn't realize that they could do that, but they do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I want to talk about the new studio space. So this is, you think maybe February, March, you'll be all fully moved in and ready to go with that, right?
Yep, definitely by March it has to be.
And now I'm imagining that as people hear about this program, other people will say, hey, why can't we do that? Have you had many people saying, hey, how do we do this? I'm just thinking there might be some people here on the Cape. There's lots of musicians out here that might want to follow your lead.
There have been quite a few people who have asked if we are elsewhere. Mm-hmm. If we have, I think, like Connecticut and California and Maine.
Also. And North Shore.
And we are not yet elsewhere, but we're more than happy to help people start something like this. It's actually not incredibly difficult. You need a good community, you need a strong group of musicians, and you need a dedication for not inclusion as an accommodation, which is something we were talking about, but inclusion just because this is how the world is and is working. And I think for Muse, one of the big things that kind of separates us is that we are new, and we were formed in a time during the neurodiversity movement, and we have an outlook on the way that we are going to evolve and hopefully help society to evolve with us by having events and having concerts and creating self-determination. And some of the musicians are writing blogs for us now, mm-hmm. and I'll be posting them on our website. So just having an ability to have a voice and to have, you know, this identity and to have autonomy in your community.
Yeah. I'm going to have a little bit more than a minute left, but I want you to tell the story about Sri and the violin. This is such
right.
a great story.
So we call them genius moments, and they happen really often. One of the concerts, Sri, who's a violinist, was playing the violin, and my wife, Elaine, who's his violin teacher, was looking at him being like, oh, his fingers are all wrong, but it sounds perfect. What is going on? So after the song finishes and they're on a break, Elaine goes over there and checks the violin, and it was completely out of tune, but Sri was playing it perfectly because he plays everything by ear, which is just an incredible talent, especially for the violin.
Oh, it's amazing. Well, we're going to have a link with more information about the Muse Foundation as well as Susan Senator's books at our website, capeandislands.org. Your book, Susan, by the way, very helpful.
Thank you.
Great advice. So Mibi Shields, Brett Lucicek, and Susan Senator, thanks so much for joining us. And best of luck with this venture. It sounds fantastic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.